This is David Hufford. The Transcendent Function, Ego, Self, and Symbol. February 17th, 1995. Tape 1 of 2.
Are you here tonight? Am I on yet?
Yes, sir.
Yes? Okay, good. I can hear myself, but I don't know if anybody else can. The reason why I wanted to give this lecture and talk about this subject, when I was asked if I would give a talk in this series, is because the transcendent function is a very passionate interest of mine, particularly in terms of what I connect with and what my experience is of this very, it seems sometimes very mystical or mysterious process in Jungian psychology. In my write-up, I did say that the transcendent function is perhaps the most pivotal notion in Jungian psychology, and my sense of that was increased as over the last few months I have read just about everything Jung wrote about the transcendent function, and a few things that other people wrote about it. And I became aware not only that the transcendent function is something that was very instrumental in Jung's development, both personally and as a therapist, but also that it seems that practically everything he wrote after he developed the notion and sort of came to the discovery of the transcendent function, almost everything else that he wrote after that in some way referred to this process. As a beginning tonight, what I'd like to do is just start with talking a little bit about how Jung came to this idea, because he came to it in a very personal way. When Jung broke with Freud in somewhere between 1911 and 1913, that precipitated a real emotional crisis for him. This was a very vital and important relationship, and he spent at least through 1916, anywhere from 3 to 5 years, struggling with the emotional trauma of this, the ending of this relationship. And it was out of that 3 to 5 year period that he went into his unconscious and struggled with the images that he found there, and found a way over time to come to terms with them, to understand them. And it was at the culmination of this period, when he was just beginning to come out of this very introverted, very inward, very painful time, that he wrote 4 papers. 2 of the papers were not really related that much to what he was struggling with. They were papers that later he revised and published a few years afterwards. But 2 things that he wrote. One was a paper entitled The Transcendent Function, and the other was essentially an act of imagination, something that was brought to him or compelled toward him. He came to a point where he had to write something that he titled The 7 Sermons to the Dead. It was a long poem, in essence. It apparently was written in very archaic German. And when he wrote that, he felt a great sense of relief that something had broken, something had been completed. Now, the 7 Sermons to the Dead and the Transcendent Function were put away. He didn't publish either one of them. The Transcendent Function was written in 1916, and it wasn't officially published until 1957, over 40 years later. And that was only because in 1957, as he was realizing that he was coming to the end of his life, and they were in the process of publishing the collected works, that this got brought out and published. But it was put away for 40 years. And essentially the same thing happened with the Seven Sermons to the Dead. The Seven Sermons to the Dead was privately published, but it was not public. And eventually, in 1952, was brought out by students that were archiving in his archives and convinced Jung to publish it. He was very reluctant to publish it. He eventually did publish it at the end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. But he referred to it as a folly of his youth, and that he didn't think that it was really something important. At least that's what he said publicly. He didn't think that it was something important to publish. Well, if you look at the Seven Sermons to the Dead, what it really is an active imagination poem which encapsulates, which symbolizes everything that he talked about in the article, The Transcendent Function. In a way, the Seven Sermons to the Dead was one of the living symbols that came out of that 3 or 4 year struggle with the unconscious. And I just want to give you a little bit of the background of it, because this can seem like a very dry and intellectual notion. Well, just one more notion in analytical psychology that's theoretical and about the archetypes and about different things, but doesn't really speak to us. And I think it's helpful to realize that this notion came out of an intense personal emotional struggle in a very brilliant man. And one of the things that I read in preparing and finding out more about this topic was a short article in which a Jungian analyst talks about the transcendent function and talks about what he says. Well, he notices that it's only mentioned in about 7 or 8 places in the collected works. And it's not Jung really doesn't use the term after about 1939. And he says, well, Jung must have decided that it wasn't a useful term anymore. It was that he moved away from the notion of the transcendent function. Well, what I realized in looking at everything that he wrote about the transcendent function and then thinking about his work in general is that if you look at everything that he wrote after 1916, it all, in one way or the other, refers to this process. Everything that he wrote, essentially, everything that he worked on after 1916 was essentially his way of trying to work through intellectually and theoretically and psychotherapeutically what he experienced in that 4 to 5 year period. Everything he ever wrote after that was a way to try and come to terms with what he experienced. And it seems to me that almost everything he wrote in some way or another is a description of the transcendent function, even if he never uses that word or that phrase. Everything that he wrote, for example, the main thing that he wrote on psychotherapy, on transference, you can read that, and you can read it as a description of the transcendent function in the therapeutic situation. The Mysterium Conjunctionis, which was the last major thing that he wrote, is, I don't have it here, but it's a real big thick volume, and it's all about conjunction of the opposites, the mysterious conjunction in alchemy. And it is about the transcendent function as alchemy expressed it. Probably his most controversial piece of writing, and for me his most important writing, was Answer to Job. It was written in 1951 or 52, I think. And Answer to Job is all about this. I can't remember. I don't think he actually uses the term once in Answer to Job. But the entire book, a very personal, it's probably, other than the Seven Sermons to the Dead, it's probably the most personal thing he ever wrote. In some ways, it's even more personal than his autobiography, because his autobiography is talking about his personal history. Answer to Job is struggling with his anger and his emotional anguish at the God concept, the Judeo-Christian Yahweh concept. And so it's a much more personal book than even his autobiography is, because he gives you more of his emotional feelings and reactions in that book. And it's all about the transcendent function as it is experienced in a religious or a spiritual context. Well, I should say too that what I'd like to do tonight, what I would very much like to have happen tonight, is I would like us to have a conversation. And I don't want to give a formal lecture. I would like to continue to give a little background, a little more information about the transcendent function, and what is passionate for me about this process. Just perhaps so that we all have at least a place to start from. And then I would like to open it up to a conversation. And hopefully, if I can convey to you some of the passion and the energy that I have and feel around this, then I will feel like it's been worth being here tonight. So, I assume everybody has two handouts. Yes. Extra. Are there some out there? Okay.
I can share.
Well, there are plenty of copies. So, this is basically a diagram of the process as it happens. And one thing, I couldn't figure out a way to draw it, so I just have to tell you that I want you to all imagine that this is not just a circle, but a spiral. That this is a process that is not just a one-time process. It's a process that repeats itself throughout our entire life. And this is a spiral in the sense that each time we come back around, we just don't come back around, hopefully, to the same place we started. But each time we reach a new symbolic attitude, we have moved to a, let's say, a more conscious state of awareness for ourselves. But then we have to start the process over again. We have to then come to terms with what comes up in reference to that new place that we're at. So let me just sort of walk us through this and see what we find here. Well, basically, let's start at the top here, because we start with a one-sided conscious attitude. And in a way, that's kind of redundant, because the conscious attitude by its very nature is one-sided, which is to say that because we're conscious, we have focused our attention and we have chosen or we have found ourselves not focusing on things that either we didn't find important or as we were growing up we felt were things we didn't like about ourselves or about our world, and so we chose not to think about those things. We chose not to concentrate on those things. Of course, that becomes the personal shadow. But so what we all start with a one-sided conscious attitude. But you know, one of the things that Jung said was that the transcendent function is the result of the tendencies of both the unconscious and the conscious. And consciousness wants to focus. Consciousness wants to separate and become itself, separate from the unconscious. So consciousness is always trying, is always choosing sides, if you will. The unconscious, its general tendency is to compensate, is to balance things out. And so when we end up with a one-sided conscious attitude, the unconscious responds in its natural way by saying, well, okay, so you're over here, well then we need to create something over here because we need balance and we need wholeness here. So what happens is we come to a conscious standpoint, which is the ego saying, here I am and this is what I want to do, and you know, if I just use my reason and my mind, I can figure it out and I can figure out the solution to any problem. Well, the unconscious comes along and says, yeah, but what about this over here? And so a one-sided attitude ends up causing a tension, a conflict, an opposition between the conscious attitude and what gets constellated in the unconscious as a result. And you notice that what I have here is I have the conscious and unconscious labeled reason and grace. And the reason I do that is because what we have to do if we want to consciously and with intention go into this process in a healing way for ourselves, what we have to do is we have to be willing to be conscious of what comes up. We have to be willing to be conscious of what the unconscious brings us. We have to be willing to hold both of these in consciousness, both sides of whatever conflict we're feeling, whatever conflict we're experiencing. We have to be willing to acknowledge the other side of that conflict and hold them both what our conscious, our ego intention, and what is coming up as a conflict to them. Reminds me, Edward Edinger said that actually it's in this book here, Transformation of the God Image. He says at one point that every time, it's a good bet that every time you find yourself in conflict with another person or some aspect of your life, it's because the unconscious has decided that you need to be aware of something. Almost every time. So you can imagine how often this process goes on, because I don't know about you, but I find myself, you know, always dealing with conflicts and tensions and how do I resolve it. And so the problem is that we can't force a resolution. I mean, we can. We do it all the time in one sense. We force a resolution by saying, well, we're just going to pick one side of this conflict to support, and we're just, that's what we're going to do. Well, that's not what happens if we are going to follow the movement of the transcendent function. That what we have to do is we have to be willing to hold both the conscious and the unconscious equally without choosing sides, and hope that something will spontaneously come out of that tension. So that something new will emerge. But we can't make it happen. We can't make that new thing happen. We can't consciously decide what it's going to be and say, okay, that's what it is. We have to rely on grace. We have to rely on the grace of the unconscious, the grace of the psyche, the grace of God, whatever it is that you experience as that holy, unknown other that is in your life. We have to rely on the grace of that to bring us what we need, to bring us a new image of how this tension might be resolved. And if we are patient enough and lucky enough, and if we are graceful enough, what emerges is a living symbol. It's what Jung called a living symbol. Now, I know that you've had a lecture, if I remember, on the symbol. Is that right? Does everybody here know the difference between a sign and a symbol, or what a symbol is?
I focus mostly on archetypes. I think people would be well served.
Okay. The difference between a sign and a symbol is that a sign is something that stands for a known quantity. Okay. A stop sign, a yield sign, a sign that says Ballard Bitter. I mean, you know, that. You know that we know what that's referring to. No. Well, in the alehouse, it's a sign. I mean, it's saying this is a stand-in. This is something that stands in for what it is that it's referring to, and everybody knows what it refers to. You know, pretty much. But a symbol is the best possible description of something unknown. We may know something about it, but ultimately it's something unknown. And a symbol is the best possible way of describing that unknown thing, quantity, feeling, whatever it is. So that's the difference between a sign and a symbol. The thing is, a symbol is only a symbol because someone experiences it that way, because someone has an attitude which accepts the mysterious and accepts and recognizes the mysterious quality of that symbol. That there are things that used to be symbols that aren't symbols anymore. One of the examples that Jung gave was suggesting that the cross of all things might be something that used to be a symbol, but for many people no longer is, because a symbol has to have an emotional quality to it for the person experiencing it. A symbol that's the mystery, that's the unknown part. It's not just an abstract notion, it's an emotional response, an emotional connection. So for many people in modern culture, they look at a cross, they look at a Christian cross, and they say, oh yeah, that's about this. It's become in essence a sign. That's a stand-in for this experience that Christ had, or this thing I read in the Bible or something. For many people, it no longer carries the mysterious emotional quality, the numinous quality that makes it something unknown and something that draws one to it. So to be a symbol, and more specifically, to be a living symbol, it has to have that mysterious, unknown quality. It has to have an emotional energy to it in terms of one's experience of it. And Jung says that if you consciously hold the tension of whatever conflict you're in, and you wait, eventually what may arise is a living symbol, which is to say something may arise out of that tension, out of the unconscious, which propels you into a new experience and a new attitude, and not so much resolves the conflict, perhaps, but moves you beyond it, moves you into another way of experiencing what's going on. And what that leads to, if we stay connected to that symbol, that living symbol that comes up, what that leads to in us is a new symbolic attitude. It's a new attitude, a new way of looking and experiencing ourselves and our life and what's going on that allows us to experience some of the mysterious quality of life. That each time this process happens, we become a little more conscious of the symbolic, of the numinous, of the archetypal in our life. A way that Jung put it, especially in the 50s when he was writing Answer to Job, is we become aware of the God more in life. He quoted Meister Eckhart at one point. Meister Eckhart was referring to this. He didn't, of course, use these words, but he was referring to this process in his own life. And he was talking about it as being the birth of God. That what this experience of the living symbol was for Meister Eckhart was the birth of God. And that's an amazing notion. To think that we might have a responsibility, we might have a task of helping God or the goddess or the gods, whatever it is that you find numinously transcendent in a spiritual sense, that we might have the responsibility and the task of birthing that transcendent other into our life. That, in fact, that was the point. That was really one of the points of Answer to Job, is that we are responsible as human beings. We are responsible for providing an avenue for God to exist in the world. Essentially, God needs us as much as we need God. The numinous needs us as much as we desire the numinous. Because it can't exist without us. It can't exist in the world unless we give it a place to be and an avenue for existing and room to exist. And it's that... it's that way of finding out how to do that, which is the more conscious method involved in this area here that Jung talks about in his not only in his article on the transcendent function, but also I've got down here on the suggested reading list, you'll also see that I suggest you read Definition 51 in Psychological Types. In the volume Psychological Types in the back, Jung has a whole list of definitions. And interestingly enough, he doesn't have the definition of the transcendent function. If I remember correctly, it was written before he wrote, or the majority of it was written before he wrote the transcendent function. But what he does have is the Definition 51, which is a definition of symbol. And in that definition, he describes in similar but some unique ways, he describes the process of the transcendent function and how one approaches it. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about tonight, because it's part of what really interests me, is how this relates to the creative process and the experience of creation in our lives. And I don't mean only those of us who may have been able or are able to experience a conscious sense of ourselves as artists or creators, you know, saying, well, I'm a writer, or I'm a painter, or I'm a sculptor or something. But all of us experience the creative process in some way or another. And the ways in which we find and seek out a connection with the unconscious, with the images, with the emotions, with the sensations, with the ideas that come up from the unconscious in response to our living our life, the ways in which we make connection with those and find a way to be in relationship with those is the essence of the creative process. Let me I know some of you are aware of this. Over the entrance to Jung's house in Kursnacht, he had a motto put in Latin. And I won't try and read the Latin to you, because my Latin is very rusty. But in translation, and this is a translation by Jung. I found this little quote in a volume called, I think it's called Jung Speaking, or it's a paperback book of lectures and public talks and interviews that Jung gave over the years. And in there, I found somebody asked him at the beginning of a short interview about this quote that he had over his house. And he translates it as, called or uncalled, God is present. And he goes on to say, it's a Delphic oracle. In a way, you see, it contains the entire reality of the psyche. And that's a pretty amazing statement. I mean, in that one phrase, it contains the entire reality of the psyche. Yeah. Called or uncalled, God is present. So the God is going to be present in our lives whether we invite it or not, whether we seek it out consciously or not. And I suppose that's because it's the entire reality of the psyche, it also speaks directly to the transcendent function. That we come to a point where we have a choice. We can either allow the unconscious, the psyche, God, whatever you want to call it, we can either allow that to be present in our lives in an unconscious way that we have, that we are just in the grips of, or we can invoke it, we can call it, we can ask it to be present, and then take the moral and ethical responsibility on ourselves to be in relationship to what gets called forth. And that really is the essence of the transcendent function. It's being in relationship with what comes out as a result of us just living our life. You know, Jung said that, another thing Jung said about this is that this is not only something that we can consciously choose to do as a method or a process, but it's also something that happens unconsciously all the time throughout our life. This continual process of conflict and resolution and new attitude and conflict and resolution and new attitude on an unconscious level is the process of the unconscious and the conscious. It's the process that happens whether we're involved in it or not. And normally, we don't really pay much attention to it because it's normally, in everyday ways, it happens in a way that is not extreme. So we just experience it as the little tensions and either positive or negative things that happen during our normal day. Well, unconsciously, this process is going on in response to that. It's when it gets more extreme that we end up instead of with a living symbol, we end up with symptoms. You know, we're depressed or we're anxious or we are having problems in a relationship or we don't like our job or we're feeling like life isn't really worth living anymore. All of those are really symptoms, which is to say that we're experiencing something unconsciously because we're not experiencing something consciously. If we were to be in the process of being in conscious relationship with the struggle and paying attention to what the symbols are that come up out of that, then Jung says that we would not experience our emotional and psychological symptoms in the same way. They wouldn't have to be, that essentially symptoms are an unconscious expression of something that wants to have life in and through us. And if we don't give it room, then it makes room. And it makes room in a way that is very uncomfortable for us often. So what's this business about creativity? Well, for one thing, the ego can't create a symbol any more than it can will a creative act or a creative experience. We can't force ourselves to be creative. I mean, lots of times we think we do. Well, okay, I'm in school and I've got to write a paper. It's due tomorrow and, you know, I better be creative. You know, I mean, I got to get it done. It doesn't matter whether I want to or not. I got to get it done. So I got to sit down and do something. And so I think lots of times we convince ourselves that we can, on demand, find creative energy in ourselves. But really, what we finally do when we sit down to write that paper for the class the next day is we finally, in one way or another, we're giving space for something in us. And we can't make that something happen. But, you know, most of the time it does happen. Most of the time, when we finally force ourselves to make that space, something comes out of that. It's pretty remarkable anyway, in a way, because it doesn't seem that way because we convinced ourselves that we did it. But It's what's unknown to us that is important in the creative act. It is out of the unknown, the unconscious, that meaning, a living symbol, arises. What this is about is the ongoing renewal of the living symbol through allowing and through being in relationship to what is unknown in us. Here's a quote from Jung. The creative process, so far as we are able to follow it at all, consists in the unconscious activation of an archetypal image, and in an elaboration and shaping this image into a finished work. By giving it shape, the artists translate it into a language of the present, and so make it possible for us to find our way back to the deepest springs of life. So basically, creativity comes out of a symbolic attitude, comes out of being willing to be open to what is unknown, to what is possible, what is numinous in our lives. And a creative attitude and a symbolic attitude can be it's not just working on some conscious creative project, but just being aware of what happens when we are in touch with our own sense of desire, our own sense of passion, our own sense of interest in things, whatever it may be. Well, I'd like to stop here for a moment and read you one more quote, and then see at this point if there are any questions or wonders or anything we have at this point to try and begin a conversation. I feel like I've been talking a lot and like to engage all of you more. But I would like to read one more quote, because it sums up everything, certainly, that I've been saying, and in a fascinating way, sums up everything that Jung experienced. And you've probably actually heard it before in this series, because I think Dr. Yandell read it. But this is the very beginning of Jung's autobiography, the very first two sentences. It's the way he starts. And he says, "My life is a story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation. And the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole." Now, I'll just share with you that, to me, this is a remarkable statement. For Jung to say his entire life is the story of the self-realization of the unconscious. And not his self-realization, not the self-realization of his creative process or anything, or him coming to know himself, but the self-realization of the unconscious. That his whole life, the purpose of his life, was to help the unconscious become realized in life. And he says, everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation. So it's that process I was talking about before. Everything that comes up for us in an unconscious way, is seeking manifestation, is seeking embodiment in life, in our life. But then he says, the personality too desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions. Now see, there's the tension right there. Because not only is the unconscious wanting to be alive in our life, but the personality, meaning the ego, consciousness, its striving is to evolve out of the unconscious, is to evolve out of and away from, become separate from the unconscious. Which actually is a pretty good thing, because that's the only way that we can be in relationship with the unconscious, is to be separate from it. We can't be in relationship with the unconscious if we're immersed in it, if we're merged with it. So consciousness, the art, and that it can only manifest through us. Each of us, our psyche can't be here in the world any other way except through each of us. My psyche can't be in the world through you. Your psyche can't be in the world through me. We each have that responsibility. Or we each have the responsibility to decide whether we're going to respond to that or not. And then he says one last thing. Not only does the personality desire to evolve out of its unconscious conditions, but it also desires to experience itself as a whole. That's bringing it back. That it can only experience itself as a whole. The consciousness can only experience wholeness if it reconnects, if it establishes a relationship with the unconscious. And to establish a relationship with the unconscious means to come to terms with the unconscious's desire to be realized through us. Well, I have a lot more I can say, but I'd like to find out if I have stirred up any questions or anything. Yes?
For the sake of the recording, would you try to paraphrase the questions when you ask them?
Okay. Is that a question?
Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
How did, to me there seems to be some corollary here. Obviously, and you alluded to this earlier, between the encounters of individuals as well. If someone is totally not doing a very good job of getting in touch with the unconscious, will not their relationship with other individuals tend to bring out in the other individual that balance as well?
Okay, so your question is, if someone is not in good relationship with their unconscious, does that end up manifesting in their relationship with others?
Well, it's like two adults that get into that are repressing their anger, and the kids act out in order to bring it to the surface.
Well, in that instance, we might say that the kids are expressing the unconscious feelings of the parents, right? But I think the answer to your question is yes, that our relationships are really just as much experiences of relationship with the unconscious as they are experiencing relationship with other people. I have a feeling that most of the time, most of us are only about 60% conscious. I don't know whether I'm leaning too far in one direction or too far in the other, but I think most of the time we're probably only about 60% conscious if we're lucky, which means that every relationship I have, I only experience that other person probably as six. If I'm 60% conscious, I only experience that other person as 60% of who they really are. The other 40%, I'm experiencing them as some unconscious aspect of myself that is getting worked out through my relationship with them. You know, Jung said that we work out that the very first step in working out unconscious conflicts in us is to project it onto somebody else. That's the classic way, perhaps, that we in an unconscious way. That's the usual way in which we give the unconscious outward self-realization, is that we project all of those qualities on people we know, and then we relate to them. You know, and when we're in relationship, we're just as much in relationship with some part of ourselves as we are with the other person, and vice versa. That's what makes relationships so interesting, right? So unpredictable. So we're always as much struggling with something about ourselves as we are something about the other person when we're in relationship with them. Does that answer your question? You still have a question?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I'm more of a dialogue than a question.
Good. Conversation.
When you were talking about the unconscious being able to emerge into the world just now through, you know, starting through projection, before you were
yes.
Through the relationship we have with our unconscious, the only way it could get realized. And I wanted to just begin to put some clarity there by asking mm-hmm. or discussing I think it emerges even if we're not conscious of it.
Yes, absolutely. So, most of the time, probably.
Yeah, so yeah. We can become more conscious of what's emerging.
Mm-hmm.
When we have
mm-hmm.
more of a relationship with our own unconscious, because I think maybe even in older cultures before this, you know, in Egyptian times, they developed certain living simple senses, mm-hmm. but they mm-hmm. didn't know where they came from, and they didn't understand them like we were maybe mm-hmm. trying to do now.
Or they probably could have told you where they came from, but they may not be where you thought they came from. They would tell you, well, you know, the god Ra, you know, gave the pharaoh, you know, this symbol, and that would be a perfectly reasonable explanation for them how that happened. But so you're wondering about was I saying earlier that it had to be a conscious process in order to realize the aspects of each of our unconscious. Is that?
I'm struggling with that. Yeah, as our unconscious emerges, and you were talking about our relationship. You know, each of us individually has to have this relationship.
Yes.
Well, but maybe not.
Well, and if I said it, I didn't mean to say that it was that the self-realization of the unconscious had to come through our conscious act. That's the hopeful way it happens. But in fact, it happens from the moment we're born in an unconscious way. The unconscious desires self-realization and moves toward that whether we're consciously involved in the process or not. Most of the time we're not. That's what relationship is about most of the time. We get into conflict with someone, whether we're in love with them or whether we hate them or whatever. We fall in love with somebody. I mean, we're not consciously saying, okay, I've got this part of myself that needs to be realized, so I'm going to give it to that other person. I'm going to find a good person to act that out with, and I'm going to really work that process out. It happens, obviously, in a very unconscious way.
So So I guess the big question is, yeah, what's the advantage of being conscious of what's emerging?
Well, in a very one very practical advantage is that maybe I won't speak about you, but I'll speak about myself. Maybe I won't be depressed as a result of not being conscious of what's trying to emerge in me. Or maybe I won't be anxious, or maybe I won't have to get married for the third time, or you know, say, maybe we might be able to avoid some of that unconscious pain. We'll have to deal with conscious pain, but it's a more creative kind of pain than feeling stuck in symptoms of unhappiness. So that's in a practical way, that's a good reason to be. Yes?
I was just going to add on to that. I thought the why for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked that just before. I was going to comment on it. It seems to me, like in my experience, that if you don't have this relationship well done, I mean, you might have a relationship, but it may not be a good one. The ego seems to be motivated by something. And in my case, it was motivated in the correct direction. So. Mm-hmm. Later, having found a better reason, you know, for that, then I can look back and say, gee, I wish I'd known that, because that would have been directed.
So you would have gotten to where you wanted or needed wanted and needed to be sooner,
yeah,
if you'd been more conscious.
My mother just had a little slogan like that. She said, too soon old and too late wise. I feel it's easier to look back at that.
Well, we all do the best we can, don't we?
What it is, what it is possible.
Uh-huh. There was somebody. Yes.
Is there a shadow to this transcendent?
Oh, I'm sure there is. What do you have an idea of what it might be?
No, I was just wondering if you could talk about it.
What would be the shadow of the transcendent function? Yes, you have an idea.
An idea about.
Oh, good.
I sort of had a comment about what's going on before, but
okay,
it kind of incorporates this a little bit, and it's the idea, I'm thinking of dreams right now,
mm-hmm,
and I'm thinking about some conscious thoughts, one-sided conscious attitude that I've carried with me that, mm-hmm, probably have been useful to the point now in this field, and certain dreams that have come up for me lately, I think as a result of unconscious awarenesses I have,
mm-hmm,
through experiences I have to challenge these ideas somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
And last night I had a really glaring dream symbol,
mm-hmm,
that I think speaks to this trying to meld, mm-hmm, you know, trying to compensate, trying to balance out this one side of the business. But I think that the ambiguity of the symbol kind of invites me to relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm realizing also, you know, part of me that it's uncomfortable or,
mm-hmm,
stay the same or kind of, you know, resist and stay in all the same stuff. It feels like there's a choice around how much of a relationship I want with that symbol. And, you know, I'm aware in working with my dream symbols, it's like I can get help with them through talking about the dream symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really cultivate and nurture some kind of direct relationship with the symbol, which can help me maybe get this new symbolic attitude, or I can just drop it like a hot potato.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it feels to me that it's not exactly a shadow aspect, but it is some kind of part of me that wants to push that back down.
Sure, sure. Because it's... It can be painful. It can be challenging. It challenges the
uncomfortable.
Anytime we get a response from the unconscious in one way or another, it challenges the conscious attitude, doesn't it? And for us to take become aware of that or take in that other attitude means we lose something. Our ego has to give up something, has to sacrifice something, has to submit to something. And that, I mean, nobody likes to do that. Nobody likes to do that voluntarily, maybe if you're forced to, but I don't know. I don't know exactly. It's a great question. We have to give up our ego. Yeah. Well, or we have to give up what the ego identifies with, what it identifies itself as. Yes, Abraham.
I mean, I wonder whether it's related to what you didn't talk about.
Okay.
In detail, you have in parentheses under the unconscious raised the inferior function.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, there's a type dependence. So.
Yes. Yes.
On this question, what is the shadow?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if you want to think about this process from the point of view of typology, our conscious stances usually are most developed are function. And then the unconscious tends to speak through what Jung called the inferior function, or our least developed function. So there is a typology process there, which can be helpful if you're trying to find a conscious way of connecting with it. You know, it might be helpful to think about what you experience your inferior function as when you're thinking about how do I approach this? Do I approach it from going into feelings? Do I approach it from working with something in the physical world? Do I approach it with writing or images? Yes, Lucretia.
I was just thinking maybe that the shadow aspect is that what this is a gradual emerging to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And when one reaches that point of consciousness, then there is still that part that is unconscious. We're never fully conscious.
Right. Right.
It's an
evolving spiral, isn't it? And yet, it's all the unconscious is. It always remains the unknown. It always is. There's always more. Now, of course, it also occurs to me in talking about the shadow of this process, I have put the self in the middle of this, and for no good reason except that the self is in the middle of everything. So it seemed only right that that's what's really in the middle of that. And I think it's useful to remind myself that Jung was very conscious, especially in his later life, Jung was very conscious of the fact that the self is not an undivided experience or image or whatever. That it has its dark side. It has, you know, that's another theme in Answer to Job, is that when Satan came to Yahweh and said, you know, I want to make a bet with you. Yahweh was not conscious of who Satan was. I mean, there's a whole thing in there about how the process of the relationship between Yahweh and Job was not so much that Job became more conscious, but he did. He became conscious of what Yahweh was like. But it's also that through Job's consciousness, Yahweh became more conscious of what he was like. He became more conscious that he was not this all-wonderful God that he thought he was. You know, he became a little bit conscious that he had a dark side and that he had to do something about that. So maybe the shadow of the transcendent function, it is that what we have to deal with the shadow of the self, and what's our relationship? Is there a whole nother process that goes on in terms of our relationship with the shadow of the self? I don't know. Kent.
Well, it seemed to me that having the self that was very appropriate, not the self as centered, but the self as the totality.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. There is another hand, Paul.
Well, I think that to the extent that you have the unconscious represented by grace,
yes,
that may be just a partial representation of what is, you know, mm-hmm. the unconscious, what's the psyche. And the notion of grace to me communicates a gifting, something that's a that's given,
yes,
freely without necessarily being asked, or at least not articulated specifically.
It can't be willed. Yeah.
And where a gifting is implied, I think there is a process of taking away.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we can, talking about sort of the light side or the shadow side of things, we can anthropomorphize possibly the self, the psyche, or the God, to then see it as only providing the function of gifting or providing mm-hmm. this grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is that sense of, not maybe opposite, but other functions,
yes,
other functions at play.
I have a feeling you're right, and it seems to me that in experience, what this process provides most of the time, in terms of how we experience it, is it mostly provides pain and suffering. That if the grace comes in the form of the living symbol, it is something that happens only after in extreme or difficult instances. It only happens after a lot of pain and suffering. Yes?
I was thinking in theological terms.
Oh, okay.
That what you're talking about also fits the pattern of Christ's birth into humanity.
Mm-hmm.
That the divine comes and is born, is embodied
mm-hmm.
in the human. And if we look at it in that way as a symbolic
mm-hmm.
thing rather than a literal event,
mm-hmm.
Because that's kind of a pattern for this whole process.
Mm-hmm. And I believe Jung saw it that way. I think in answer to Job, he essentially says God had to enter the world as Christ because of that whole experience came out of the realization, or had its germ in the realization of what he had done to Job. That was the beginning of God, of Yahweh, coming to consciousness and realizing that he did not know what it was like to be human, maybe. That he had to experience that.
But I was looking at it from the other side.
Oh, okay.
That for whatever reason God did this, once it's done, it's like, now this is the pattern
uh-huh.
that we all have to follow again and again and again. That process has to give birth in us to the numinous, to the divine. Over and over.
Well, I suppose in a sense of looking at Christ as being the crucified ego, that more than one writer I read suggested that maybe Jung was a little too heavy in his Christian approach to this, not only because he sees it only from a Christian perspective, but also because he's so heavy on the crucifixion part of it, the suffering part of it, and didn't want to acknowledge that the creative the creative act could also be acceptable in and of itself as a part of this process. There could be some lightness to it as well. Yes.
Could you comment on what might happen when each of us suffers in this relationship or struggling with something? Mm-hmm. We get the attitude that the other person harmed us. So, for example, we hire a lawyer and we sue this person or
good idea.
Bring charges against him, or this other person caused my suffering.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not just projecting the original material, now I'm projecting maybe the suffering that this person's causing my suffering. In other words, is that a process of trying to hold out against the growth of some kind?
Certainly from this perspective, that kind of attitude is holding on to a heroic stance of I'm right and he's wrong and by God I'm going to prove it. This is not about holding the tension of the opposites. This is about he's an asshole.
And further asking someone else to do it for me.
Oh well, sure. I mean, certainly as lawyers, they're knight errants. They go out and fight our battles for us.
What's the next stage the person might go through after?
Well, let's back up a minute, where you get to the. I mean, this is one kind of suffering. This is the suffering. This is unconscious suffering. There's the conscious suffering. Is more to begin to ask oneself the question, well, yes, the guy's an asshole, and yes, he done me wrong, but I read that thing in Edinger that said every conflict I'm in with anybody is in some way the unconscious trying to make me aware of something about myself. Aware of something about myself. That guy? I mean, what's he got to do with me? I'm not like him. You mean there's some part of me that might be like him? That doesn't feel very good. To begin to hold both your own feelings and your own awareness and attitude about what's going on, and hold the possibility and begin to absorb and make conscious the possibility, what if this guy, why is it, what's it about this guy that gets my goat so much? Why is it him in particular and what he did in particular that makes me so angry? And if there's some way to start being aware that there's something in me that is like him, or there's something in me that I can experience that he's caring for me. I mean, that's a whole different kind of grief and suffering. Oh my God, him? That's terrible. Oh, I don't feel quite as noble and heroic about myself as I did. If I have to accept that there's something about him that I'm like, and to hold on to, and it, in the process of holding on to that in some way or another, or going into that in some way or another, and waiting to see what happens as a result, to hold on to the tension between the two. At one place, Jung says, well, the first thing you have to do is you have to become aware of the opposites in their conflict, whether it's out in the world or it's inside or as an image or whatever. But you hold on to them consciously, and you have to wait. And maybe, and then you maybe you find out, you wait a while and you find out that nothing happens. And it doesn't, you know, nothing has come up to relieve the tension. So what do you have to do then? You have to wait some more. You know, you just have to stick in there and hope. That's where the grace part comes in. And hope, if you witness this experience of the conflict in yourself long enough, something that the tension will build up, bringing back the tension. Whoops, bringing back the tension into you. Yes, and waking oneself up and bringing it back, and the energy builds up, and eventually, if we're lucky, the energy builds up to the point where something breaks through.
So was that a 3-year process when he wrote it?
For him, it was at least a 3-year process, yeah. And it was a very painful... Well, he held on to it, but he was very actively involved at the same time. It's both action and suffering, he says at one point. He invented for himself active imagination. He said, I'm having these dream images, or I need to find a way to figure out what's going on in the unconscious. What will happen if I allow myself to go into the unconscious and see what happens, see what emerges? And according to the way he describes it, he did that, and things started emerging. Images, figures started emerging, and he had to interact with them. He had to struggle with them. And in the meantime, he had to struggle with an incredible, we probably would call it a depression, and a sense of his life falling apart, and somehow keep that together as he worked on this unconscious process.
So there are little pieces of grace along the way also.
Every day, I hope. Every day. Yeah, it's only, you know, when we describe it this way, it sounds as if it's this big process, you know, this samadhi, this enlightenment thing that happens. And that, yeah, it's probably a description of enlightenment, but this is something in a smaller way that happens for us all the time, every day, and every time we have a dream, it happens. Every time we have a dream, the unconscious is responding to something in terms of how we're living. The unconscious is giving us something. And then the question is, are we going to respond? How are we going to respond? Are we going to say, oh, well, it was just a dream? Or, gee, wasn't that a fascinating image? I just, you know, that was just the most fun image. It was so interesting. And I just have the neatest dreams. Isn't that great? Oh, well, you know, I'll see what I'll dream tomorrow. You know? He more than one place, Jung cautions against experiencing dreams as if you were watching a movie. As if you're just watching a movie and you can walk out of the theater and, you know, you don't have any moral responsibility for what happens to the hero or the heroine or the bad guy at the end of the movie. You might feel good, you might feel bad, but say, hell, it was just a movie. You know? But your dreams are different, Jung says. Jung, in a letter that Jung wrote to somebody had written Jung a letter and said, I'm very fascinated by the collective unconscious. How do I learn more about the collective unconscious? And Jung must have been in kind of a snippy mood that day, because he wrote a letter. I don't think I have it here. Well, maybe I do. Let's see. Here it is. Here, in part, he says, I only know that there is no point in wishing to know more about the collective unconscious than one gets through dreams and intuition. The more you know of it, the greater and heavier becomes your moral burden, because the unconscious contents transform themselves into your individual tasks and duties as soon as they become conscious. So he said, what do you, are you, you don't want to know more about the unconscious if all you're going to do is, you know, think, see it as an interesting sort of philosophical or intellectual idea, you know? Because when a dream comes to us, when an image comes to us, we are being given a moral and ethical responsibility to ourselves to respond to it. We're giving a task and a burden every time a dream image speaks to us. Yes, Larry.
Listening to you talk, like I'm having one of those rare occasions when my thinking function is actually trying to do something.
Oh, good.
So I need to ask you as much as you can think for me.
I think I can do it. I don't know.
As you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that I work with a lot of angry men. And, and I was thinking this, it seems like this isn't the pure correlation, but the angrier they are, the more one-sided they seem.
I can imagine.
And the more they're into the rational, the concrete, the right, there's a right way or wrong way, the more polarized.
Yes. Yes.
And what I was wondering is if in your experience, in terms of dreams, it isn't working. in terms of dreams, and how the transcendent function might be functioning and how symbols would come up. Would you hypothesize about how that would differ between, say, a man who's extremely polarized, extremely suffering considerably,
yes,
and how that opposite, the unconscious, the inferior, might show up in his dreams compared to someone, say, who's not suffering that much, who's in a sort of...
who's in denial about?
Well, no. Yeah.
They're suffering, or
yeah, or less suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, more.
So these men that you describe, who are so angry, they don't experience themselves as suffering.
No, I would say it's more like what we were talking about earlier.
They are, by God, it's the other guy's fault, and I'm going to get him. And
it's not like they have some dilemma and they come in and they say,
yeah,
I had this dream, and the dream
is
beautiful resolution.
Well, most of the times you have to we wait years for that beautiful resolution. I mean, the dreams we have are talking about all the. I don't know if I can answer it, except very generally that. Jung said the general tendency of the unconscious is to compensate, is to be compensatory, and so the assumption would be that their dreams would be a compensatory image or reaction to what they're doing and experiencing in their conscious life, but it would be important to know what it is that they're doing and experiencing. Because I wonder so often with people that I experience that are really angry, I wonder what their experience is. Their experience isn't, in one sense, their experience isn't that their life is full of anger. Their experience probably is that their life is full of a lot of attacks and unfairness. And so I wonder if the dream images might as easily be giving compensatory reactions to that as anything else. Does anybody else have any other? Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
I think this has a lot to do with the thing that I said before. But I think it would be really hard for a man right now in the 90s to be conscious and to not be angry. And I'm also thinking of how the opposites are similar. If you get somebody to do these extreme anger,
yes,
on the way on the extreme, to what extent it's mirroring unconsciousness of somebody who's not angry at all. It's interesting to me where men are going with the collective consciousness they have about being men in this world and roles. I certainly don't speak for that, but I'm watching with a great deal of interest the revised consciousness of anger in men about their roles, about their things they have on. So I'm wondering to what extent the men in prisons or whatever has sort of been the holding ground or the shadow, if you will, for those society, and the place where that anger has sort of been residing until it comes up to consciousness.
It's a good question, good point. I don't know the answer to it, but to kind of bring both of you together, I don't know, Larry, that I answered your question either, except in a very general way. Does anybody else have any thoughts? Yes, about that.
What I was saying before, I think applies to that unconscious is providing a motivation, but because they're not in touch with the unconscious symbols. Or they don't know what this is really about. It's not directed in the right place. It's kind of like displaced aggression and so forth and so on. So by actually focusing on this, and that's quite a process, you know. And I think it's also extremely, they spent most of their life, you haven't covered this in here, but for some reason there's this story about the first part of your life trying to cover up, you know, with defense mechanisms, this unconscious thing. I mean, it has to be peeled up. Open and like an old scab that's healed. And the men that I've seen that go through that process somehow then get focused on what this is, and their energy is all redirected. You know. The anger actually shows that something's coming through, but it's just not directed at work. It's usually directed at a spouse or you know, firefighters. It could be anything. It could be at work. In my own case, it was weapons. You know.
You know, you talking about that in this general question makes me wonder about what the anger may be protecting, the inability of individuals to feel vulnerability or to experience their own vulnerability. And it reminds me too, that reminds me of something in regard to this process. I read something that John Beebe was talking about regarding the process of the transcendent function, and specifically the experience of grace. And he asked the question, he said, why is it that some people are able to be open to grace and some people aren't? What is it? What is the attitude necessary? What is the experience of oneself that's necessary in order to allow grace to happen? Because we can't make it happen. We can only allow it. So what is the attitude? And he suggests that the attitude is to be available to relationship through a stance of vulnerability. To me, he's saying that we have to be willing to be vulnerable and be in relationship to other people, to our own unconscious process, to our own pain and suffering, but we have to be willing to be vulnerable. And that's that vulnerability in relationship that allows, that is the attitude of openness to the possibility of grace that comes into our life. So it sounds like then that somebody like you're describing and that you were describing, their anger is a way of defending against what might come in that vulnerable stance, from that vulnerable place.
The question I was asking is, have you, how would the dreams of someone like that be different from? I just wonder if you've noticed.
Yeah, I don't. I wish I could give you a.
I've noticed that it's a very small number.
Have you noticed any trend or?
Well, certainly a lot of violence.
A lot of violence toward themselves.
Yeah.
See, that to me speaks to the vulnerability.
Going from one army to another army, that's polarity. But it just seems to me that that somehow, I haven't quite figured out if there's a real qualitative difference between those dreams and the dreams of men that come in and say who are sort of dealing with standard therapeutic process, as opposed to somebody who comes in because of these violence.
Right. As opposed to maybe men who might come in who feel identified with vulnerability but don't feel any sense of strength about being who they are, maybe.
But I think you're right. I think these guys are carrying the shadow. Right? I think that's the first thing I learned. Gee, these guys are different from me, you know? And that's just this threat, sir.
Yes.
Is another word for grace inspiration? I'm wondering what other words there are for
you. You don't like that word. It has too much of a theological connotation to you. Yeah, right. I'd have to get out the thesaurus. My sense of inspiration is that it is, well, it is something that comes up.
Your gift, but it's not just a gifting and a being gifted to, but it's the ability to accept that which is given.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's the vulnerability aspect again, too, that one needs to actually open to that which is coming to one.
Yes.
Cover 3 months ago, Stephen King was at LAK.
Oh,
he was using the term not knowing. It's similar to how you were using this. Openness, the vulnerability.
Yes. And that's interesting because another way to think about the shift in attitude that has to happen in order to be open to grace is it's a shift from knowing and wanting control to wanting relationship and understanding. So it's that being willing to give up knowing and being willing maybe to embrace unknowing.
What comes up for me? What comes up for me is this phrase by Jung, called or uncalled, God is present.
Yes.
And for me, what I'm recalling is like an illness, a real bad illness, where the grace can come at that time, where the person may not be previously, before the illness, may not have wanted the grace or was seeking it. And it comes through that. Whether he wants it or not.
Whether he wants it or not.
And that's,
right.
This speaks to that.
Right.
So I'm thinking grace comes anyway, in a sense.
It does, and yet I suspect that we often don't experience it as grace. Your example of an illness puts me in mind of the times when I find myself in bed, sick, or with a headache or something, and it takes me a while to realize that, well, maybe my body's telling me I have to do something, I have to stop, you know, or I have to shift, and I wasn't willing to do it consciously, so my unconscious did it for me, and that is a moment of grace, but it's experienced as a headache or as an upset stomach or as the flu or something, you know, but. Yes.
But maybe that's why Jung said that our symptoms are our greatest treasures.
Yes. If we could only experience them that way, we would be in that symbolic attitude, wouldn't we? We'd be going a long way toward experiencing even the most painful part of ourselves as something full of life, full of possibility. Yes, Lucretia.
I was wondering if the question, what is the function, or what is the shadow of the transcendent function, could also be stated as, where is the shadow in the transcendent function? That's a little different.
Yes, that is different.
But I'm wondering if that is what you were asking, or were you really asking, what is the shadow? Because the shadow is inherent, I think, in that transcendent function. One has to integrate it to experience the transcendent function. So I didn't know if you were really looking for what is the shadow or where is it.
Yeah, well, certainly the shadow is in all this part here, right? I mean, our shadow, and having to come to terms with our shadow. I don't know, coming back to that question, I wonder if a possible shadow of this process itself is hubris, is imagining that we are going to we are going to become like God. You know, we are going to realize a sense of wholeness and be perfect people without any shadow at all. You know, we're just going to integrate it all, you know, and we're just going to not have a shadow. I think that's a shadow attitude, I think. Yes?
I wonder if it's in keeping you know what the second one means.
Wanting to hold on to it or grasp it in a heroic way rather than accept it in this vulnerable way of just, my God, it's...
I'm wanting to examine all of the facets of it, not just the ones that she was saying, not just the ones that were comfortable.
Yes, yes.
The ones that fit snugly with who we are.
But also the sharp edges as well as the nice, comfortable. Yes.
When you talk about this, it's very nicely intellectualized and verbalized.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about it in terms of our experience of art.
Yes.
And
good.
Our ability to experience this transcendent function without any words.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many people in the world possibly who have experienced it or are experiencing it all the time who don't know anything about Jung.
Oh, sure. Sure. This is a, you know.
So, how does it happen for them without these words?
Well, it happens.
The experience of, for instance, a cathartic experience with a work of art, Beethoven or Shakespeare,
or
tragedies. I mean, it's happening, it's embodied in, the transcendent function is embodied in that work of art.
Yes.
As we experience as the artist relates to us without saying anything.
Well, and it's embodied in our experience of being in a creative process and being...
Mm-hmm.
Being creative ourselves in some way.
But I think, for me, I think I have to make some gradations.
Mm.
And I don't want to get into good art and bad art, but even any minor creative work that I do is not equal to my experience of...
Well,
I mean, they're touchstones that really move us.
There are.
And we don't have to say, we don't have to verbalize it. It's, in some ways, it seems to me that not verbalizing it has a more powerful effect. And as she just said, that maybe if we don't think we have to explain the symbols, if we just feel the symbols.
There, you know, in more than one place, Jung wrote something to the effect that there are times and there are people for whom the hands know better than the rational mind. You know, our hands know things that our mind doesn't. So that's certainly speaking to that non-verbal experience that we need to be often. I think we need to be willing to let that part of ourselves speak in its language, whatever that language is, that doesn't have a voice, and often that means the part of ourselves that doesn't speak at all.
Well, he played with water and did various things.
And building little stone villages on the shore of the lake.
So it just occurs, when we're talking about this and we're analyzing it and we think about going into a therapeutic situation, talking about our dreams and analyzing them, I just wonder if that's maybe making the whole transcendent function too verbal. And it possibly could be accomplished on an entirely different level.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the reasons why using the arts in therapy can be so helpful, you know, to have people draw. I mean, lots of times when somebody's having, I've had a paper and some drawing stuff next to the couch, and when somebody's having trouble verbalizing, I say, you know, what do your hands say about this? See, just, you know, yes?
Well, in regards to this art thing, this is just my opinion only, but it seems that we rate the artists as how great they are, as really as how well we can project some experience into what they created. In other words, the artist is kind of like, we say they're great because they maybe tune themselves into the collective unconscious or whatever, so that more people, when they experience that art, they feel something.
Mm-hmm.
So we say that was great.
Right.
You know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, I was trying to relate to what you said, but it's not, there's nothing spoken about it in the sense that you don't have to be a Jungian to do that.
No.
All you have
to
do is sort of like tune into that unconscious. Mm-hmm. And if art is good because people say it's good, you know, it's like this projection of it, so you get some feeling from it.
Mm-hmm. It all goes back to what Jung said made a living symbol. A symbol lives only because the person experiencing it has an emotional relationship to it. And it could be a Beethoven symphony, it could be a watercolor that your three-year-old daughter did, it could be you baking an apple pie, it could be anything. It's not how great in an official sense it is, it's what is your emotional relationship to it. If it moves you, then it's a living symbol.
But I think in your great works of art, you've got the tensions.
Yes.
And that's maybe the difference.
The difference between a great work of art and a personal symbol is that a great work of art is one that can move most people. You know, it can move, it has a more universal, living symbolic energy to it. Yes?
This is going to really change the...
Oh, not too much.
In the Scientific American, you know, they're talking, a recent article, I think it's February, but they're talking about manic depressive as being a...
Oh, I think that was a couple months ago.
Is it?
Yeah.
But that being present and maybe great artists...
Yes. That's right.
And, it comes to me that this tension, you know, they undergo these swings.
Yes.
Those changes they have to create something to try to explain it. So these symbols come out of there.
Well, there is a lot of relationship, isn't there, between people with manic depressive experience and great art.
The question is asked in the article, what if they start treating these people with psychotropic drugs?
Well, before we end, I'd like to read to you one last quote, and it seems appropriate what we're talking about. This is in a letter that Jung. It's on the handout I gave you, and it's in a letter that Jung wrote just about 6 months before he died, and he writes. We have simply got to listen to what the psyche spontaneously says to us. What the dream, which is not manufactured by us, says is just so. It is the great dream, which has always spoken through the artist as a mouthpiece. All his love and passion, meaning the artist's, his values, flow towards the coming guest, to proclaim his arrival. What is the great dream? It consists of the many small dreams and the many acts of humility and submission to their hints. It is the future and the picture of the new world which we do not understand yet. We cannot know better than the unconscious and its intimations. There is a fair chance of finding what we seek in vain in our conscious world. Where else could it be? So, thank you very much.